This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 25, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Mass protests have led to the collapse of Kyrgyzstan's government. Legislation in Wisconsin seeks to prohibit the state university from prescribing emergency contraception. And it's been 29 years since a coup in Argentina ushered in a violent dictatorship. We'll hear from Buenos Aires. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Georgetown University students ended their 9-day hunger strike after university officials agreed to an immediate wage and benefit increase for school employees. Ingrid Drake reports from the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Students, workers, local labor leaders, and Georgetown University officials have negotiated one of the most comprehensive living wage policies at a U.S. university. All agreed yesterday, Georgetown employees will receive at least $13 per hour beginning in July, with the promise of annual cost of living increases thereafter. Freshman Katie Berlin Schlesinger with the Living Wage Coalition says the victory was the result of years of activism.
Students started talking to the workers around them, people that clean their dorms and clean their classrooms, and learned about their lives and learned at that point they were only making $6.25 an hour and were working two or three jobs and never seeing their children.
The coalition will oversee the implementation of the policy and will continue to push for card check neutrality, which did not make it into the agreement.
If 30% of a workforce signs a union card, there's a 90-day waiting period during which unions can't contact employees. This is really a large concern of ours for Marriott, which is a huge union-busting company and runs our dining halls.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake with the D.C. Radio Co-op.
A U.S. conscientious objector has lost the first round in his bid to receive asylum in Canada. Kristen Schwartz has more from CKLN.
Jeremy Hinsman enlisted 3 years ago. He applied for conscientious objector status before being deployed to Afghanistan in 2002, but his application was turned down. When he was ordered to deploy to Iraq as a combatant, he decided to leave the service and seek refugee status in Canada. At the Immigration and Refugee Board, he argued that the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq is illegal under international law, an argument that the board refused to consider. He will be appealing the decision. His lawyer, Jeffrey House, said yesterday in a press conference following the release of the Refugee Board's decision,
If the board and if the courts don't find Jeremy to be a convention refugee, it doesn't exhaust the procedures and we'll have to start to ask political officials to make the decisions.
Seven other former U.S. soldiers have made similar applications in the Toronto area, and dozens more are living in Canada without coming forward. Several stood with Jeremy yesterday and reiterated their hope that they will be able to stay in Canada. From Toronto, this is Kristen Schwartz for Free Speech Radio News.
Former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet has again been granted immunity from charges of murder by the nation's high court. Jorge Garatón reports from Santiago, Chile.
In a 15-4 resolution, Chile's Supreme Court denied a prosecution demand to remove Pinochet's parliamentary immunity in the 1974 murder in Buenos Aires, Argentina, of his predecessor at the head of the army, General Carlos Prats. Prats and his wife were killed in an exclusive Buenos Aires district when the car they were riding in exploded. Secret Service operatives working under the orders of Chile's then secret police carry out the operation. The court denied the prosecution's demand on a legal technicality. The court argued it had previously ruled in the matter when it denied a 2002 request by an Argentine judge to extradite Pinochet to that country to face prosecution. To date, only one secret police operative is behind bars in Argentina after he was found guilty of the double murder. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
More than 10 million children under the age of 5, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, die each year from preventable causes, according to a new report. Samuel Okoye reports from Lagos.
The report, which was compiled by World Health Organization advisors, confirmed the enormity of global public health, especially as it affects children. According to the report, about half of the more than 10 million children that die yearly are from sub-Saharan Africa. The report identified pneumonia, diarrhea, malaria, premature birth, and measles as some of the leading causes of death. Poor nutrition and poverty were identified as the main causes of these conditions. Sub-Saharan Africa has the greatest health crisis in the world. Poverty and disease in many parts of Sub-Saharan Africa have been further compounded by the huge debts owed Western creditors. In Nigeria, the country's legislators have asked that further debt payment be suspended because the debt burden is causing hardship. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Mass protests in Kyrgyzstan have led to the collapse of the government. President Askar Akayev has resigned, although protests and looting continue. Several deaths have been reported as protesters attacking government buildings clashed with police, although police presence has diminished in the past day. Here to talk to us about the developments in Kyrgyzstan is Dr. Gregory Gleason. He's a professor of political science at the University of New Mexico. Can you give us an idea of how opposition protesters were able to oust their government?
The government of Askar Akayev has been in place since 1991. When it was first established, Akayev, who was not himself a high Communist Party member, but who was in the Communist Party and whose job in the Academy of Sciences of Kyrgyzstan was to monitor other party members, was thrust into the position of president of the Academy of Sciences, and then as a result of a split vote in the parliament of the country, was chosen as a compromise candidate that no one expected as president of the country. So Akayev came into office in 1991 unexpectedly, without a political background, without a political profile, without any real political, public political experience. He was not a Soviet politician by any means. But as the Soviet Union collapsed, he distinguished himself as a strong supporter, as a champion of democratic reform. Akayev distinguished himself as a proponent of Western-style democracy and liberal market reforms, and he certainly made every effort to go in that direction. But the country is without, let's put it this way, an advantageous trading position. It's a country that's backed up against mountains. It doesn't have much to trade other than substantial gold reserves, and it sold the rights of those to a Canadian firm. And so it's a country that has remained very poor and in very difficult circumstances. Akayev was first elected in the anticipation that he would have a four-year term. He's managed to have the constitution amended to allow him to continue to remain in office. And consequently, over these years, Akayev has developed quite a large number of opponents within his own government. That's what pushed him out of power.
And former Prime Minister Bakiyev has taken the post of acting president of Kyrgyzstan. He himself resigned as prime minister over the killing of six peaceful protesters by police in 2002. Talk about his background and what his chances are of staying in power.
Well, Laura, I think that saying that he resigned is a gracious way to put it. He was forced out of power by Akayev, and he was basically forced out of power because Akayev decided that either the entire government was going to be so discredited that Akayev would be pushed out of power, or Akayev would sacrifice a number of high-ranking officials. And Bakiyev, who was one of his closest proteges, was the person that he sacrificed. And with Bakiyev, of course, all of the other ministers, that is to say the complete cabinet of ministers, was swept away. Now, the interesting thing about this circumstance is that all these people stayed in Bishkek. I've talked to them. I've interviewed them. They were very, very, how to put it, disappointed at this turn of events. They felt that they were made scapegoats for miscalculations that were basically Akayev's fault. So when you say that Bakiyev resigned, he resigned under the circumstances of being forced out of office, basically. And I don't think that anyone expected that at that point that there would be this kind of revolution. I think what they expected is that eventually Akayev would accede to democratic processes and be willing to allow fair and free elections to take place. I think that coming to power in these circumstances is not something that they calculated on, nor is it something that is particularly advantageous from their point of view.
Dr. Gregory Gleason is a professor of political science at the University of New Mexico. The United Nations agreed to send 10,000 peacekeepers to southern Sudan, but the United States' refusal to support the International Criminal Court could slow accountability of the war-torn region. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
In a 15-0 vote, the Security Council passed a resolution that will send international support to aid southern Sudan's peace agreement. The peace agreement reached this past January between the government of Sudan and the Sudan People's Liberation Army movement ended a 21-year-long civil war. The United States resolution consolidates all international aid to the UN mission in Sudan. It will manage 10,000 peacekeeping troops and 700 civilian officers to monitor the ceasefire agreement, aid in disarmament, and return millions of refugees and displaced persons. Deputy to the American Ambassador to the UN, Stuart Holliday.
The transitional government is going to be strengthened and consolidated as part of this resolution that we passed to monitor the North-South agreement.
Although the resolution doesn't pertain directly to the Darfur region in western Sudan, in which the government-backed Arab militia has displaced more than 1 million people and killed 300,000, mostly women and children, it reaffirms the need for security and aid to the region. In a written statement, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan welcomed the Council's adoption, but said the Council must address issues of Darfur in order to end the violence. He specifically spoke on the idea of sanctions and the International Criminal Court. The Security Council plans to take up resolutions on sanctions and the ICC next week. France will introduce a resolution that holds Sudanese criminal leaders accountable under the International Criminal Court, but the United States has veto powers and has maintained strong opposition to the ICC because they don't want prosecutions on its own citizens. John Washburn, convener of the American Non-Governmental Coalition of the ICC, or AMIC, said that if the United States vetoes, it would leave no other working option to hold violators accountable.
No other way can be as satisfactory as the ICC, because the ICC is up and running and ready to go. It has the budget, it has the people, it has the capacity to take hold of the Darfur case immediately. Any other avenue means making something from scratch, which means months and months and months and months of delay just to put a structure together before you can even address the question of prosecuting the crimes.
11 Security Council members, a number that is enough to pass the vote, have affirmed the resolution. In order to appease the United States, the French have included in their resolution that no human rights workers or peacekeepers can be indicted to the ICC. The United States has not yet indicated whether they will veto or abstain, but they have released a separate resolution that will hold Sudanese war criminals accountable through other bodies such as the African Union. Again, Deputy to the American Ambassador, Stuart Holliday.
The issue really is one that is significant enough that we need to consider the role of the African Union in this process. Obviously, what kind of reconciliation effort would be undertaken in the country. But make no mistake about it, we want these people punished.
Meanwhile, international support for the ICC is gaining. The Vatican affirmed their support last week, as did the religious Ekoli leaders from northern Uganda and the Ugandan government. The ICC is currently investigating crimes in Uganda. For Free Speech Radio News in New York, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Brother Cornel West, I'm just hoping and praying that you have the good enough sense to always tune in to Free Speech Radio News. Lays bare the truth and inspires you to fight for justice. Free Speech Radio News.
Thousands of Argentines have rallied to mark the 29th anniversary of a military coup that ushered in the country's last dictatorship that was supported by the U.S. government. During the five-year so-called dirty war, the junta maintained strict limits on people's freedoms and cracked down on political dissidents. Tens of thousands of people were detained, tortured, and murdered. There were two different mobilizations in Buenos Aires that marked the anniversary of the coup. One opposes the current government, and the other one supports it. Matt Goldin reports.
The mother of the Plaza de Mayo, Argentine women who protest the disappearance of their sons during the military regime, led the march. More than 100,000 people took part in the demonstrations, including human rights activists, workers, picateros, and students. In 1976, one of the most bloody dictatorships of South America began. 30,000 people were disappeared or arrested. They were kidnapped and tortured in clandestine detention centers. The dictatorship enjoyed political support from the U.S. government, as proved by the classified U.S. State Department documents last year, in which a meeting was registered between the Argentine General Guzzetti and the U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Historian Felipe Piña.
An interesting thing to remember was when Nobel Peace Prize winner Henry Kissinger said to the Argentine military men that it was necessary to be careful if they were going to foster a coup d'etat, that they don't leave the bodies in the streets. That would be a very bad image for the international press. After this meeting, the disappearances began. We must remember the connection between the State Department, the CIA, and the Argentine military coup. The role of the United States was very important.
Though demonstrations took place throughout the country, the biggest was in Buenos Aires. Cristian Castillo of the Socialist Workers' Party.
In this act, we denounce the continuation of the genocide of the 70s in the case of President Kirchner. His Minister of Defense has just received Rumsfeld, one of the principals in charge of the massacre in Iraq. This is not an act of memory, but is an act of struggle to face yesterday's massacre and also to face today's oppressors.
The ones which support the current government made an act and read a document without any political claims or disagreements with the actual president, and they tried to not mention the differences with the other act. Nora Cortiñas, president of Mother of Plaza de Mayo, found online.
It is important that this year more people came than in other years. Though the slogans are the same, we can't reach an agreement. But that does not keep us from being in the plaza or from coming with our photos of our disappeared persons and demonstrating that we will continue to fight.
The Mother of Plaza de Mayo and the thousands of others will continue to say never more. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Matt Goldin and Zula Warken from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
The wives of two Cubans jailed on espionage charges in the U.S. are petitioning the United Nations High Commissioner on Human Rights because they have not been allowed to visit their husbands in prison. From Geneva, Julia Steinberger reports.
Mi nombre es Olga Salanueva. Soy esposa de René González. René González.
My name is Olga Salanueva. I am the wife of René González, and René González is serving a 15-year sentence in Florida.
Yo soy Adriana Pérez, esposa de Gerardo Hernández.
My name is Adriana Pérez. I'm the wife of Gerardo Hernández. Gerardo Hernández is serving two life sentences plus 15 years in a federal court in California.
In 2001, five Cubans were charged and convicted for espionage in Miami. Since then, their families have been struggling for basic visiting rights. Olga Arango and Adriana Perez have not been granted visas by the United States and have not seen their husbands in over 4 years. They are in Geneva for the third time to petition the UN Commission on Human Rights.
And we have also come to denounce the injustices and the violations of their human rights in the prisons in the United States, and also the violations of human rights of their families.
Amnesty International sent some recommendations to the American government, expressing concerns about the detention conditions.
Gerardo Ducos, a spokesperson for Amnesty International in London.
Also, we requested that the families of these prisoners have access to them.
Amnesty International also released a report last week demanding the release of 71 prisoners of conscience in Cuba. Gerardo Ducos explains.
Amnesty calls for the abolition or modification of law number 88. The law criminalizes the contact that any Cuban citizen may have with, for example, officials from American embassies, or just for giving information to international NGOs that at some point are critical of the human rights situation in Cuba.
The Amnesty International report on Cuba also calls for an end to the U.S. embargo, claiming that it is behind many of the human rights violations within Cuba. Meanwhile, Olga Arango and Adriana Perez want people in the United States to know that neither they nor their husbands are a threat to the American people.
This is a unique opportunity just to express our views about this case, because there is a wall of silence that has been built around this case. And lastly, I want to say that these five Cuban prisoners are not terrorists. Actually, they are fighters against terrorism, and they were infiltrated in those terrorist organizations to prevent terrorist actions against the Cuban people, but not only against the Cuban people, but also against the U.S. people.
While Olga and Adriano await the decision of the U.N. Commission on Human Rights, they believe their best hope of seeing their husbands soon lies in the solidarity of people in the United States. Reporting from Geneva, Switzerland, this is Julia Steinberger for Free Speech Radio News.
Protesters gathered in cities throughout California yesterday to mark 11 years since the state passed the three strikes law, the most rigid sentencing in the nation. From KPFK in Los Angeles, FSRN's Paige Getz has more.
And it's not really easy to see our brother in jail when he's crying every single day. He's doing 25 years to life, and I don't think that's fair whatsoever. So basically, he's going to get out when he's 50.
Najim Velusa's brother got his first strike at 16. Now 23, he's one of thousands serving 25 to life for a nonviolent offense as a result of California's three strikes law. Velusa joined FACTS, Families Against California Three Strikes, for a candlelit vigil in South Central Los Angeles last night, one of several protests throughout the state to commemorate the 11-year anniversary of the passage of the law. Though 26 other states have similar laws mandating severe sentences for repeat offenders, California is the only state that doesn't require that the third conviction be a violent offense. The post-three-strike justice system is full of stories like these: ex-felons locked up for life for stealing food, according to Jerry Silva, executive director of FACTS.
It is not right for a person to spend a life term for a petty theft. It just isn't. Under nobody's, no normal thinking person thinks that's right. But California does it. But then it needs to go back to an imperfect system that it was before, where the time is somewhat commensurate with the crime, or maybe that we really treat the problem and that we don't incarcerate the problem, because we're not getting rid of it, are we?
Some 4,200 nonviolent offenders are serving life sentences as a result of the law for crimes as minor as stealing baby formula. The California prison system is riddled with overcrowding and recidivism, costing taxpayers nearly $6 billion a year, according to the Department of Corrections. Since 1980, the number of prisons has tripled in the state, but California facilities hold 160,000 inmates, twice as many as they were designed to accommodate. Each person in prison costs nearly $31,000 a year to incarcerate. Among them are many suffering from addictions, like Stanley B., a former inmate who says he just needed a drug rehab.
And it's extremely hard because my parole office was right where I used to cop drugs at, and where they sent me at, because I didn't have no place to go, which was downtown Skid Row, was drug infested, so it was very hard to get clean. And it's 25 years to life to deter me from going back, especially for something as crazy as that. I mean, a $10 rock is not worth for me spending the rest of my life behind bars.
The fastest growing population of incarcerated Californians are black women, and nearly half of female inmates are serving time for drug-related offenses. The Justice Policy Institute released a report last year that found African Americans received life sentences at 12 times the rate of white defendants, and 75% of strikers are people of color. Proposition 66 sought to amend the draconian law to make it applicable only to violent offenders, but the measure died on the November ballot by a narrow margin after an aggressive propaganda campaign financed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I mean, I voted for Arnold Schwarzenegger, but it was the first time I'd seen a politician straight look me in the eye on television and lie, because the figures he gave were totally inaccurate. Basically, he kind of used an alarmist approach, you know, give people the impression that there's going to be a mass exodus of child molesters and pedophiles that were going to be released on the community, and that simply wasn't the truth.
Several state bills are in the works to reform the system. Assembly Bill 50 seeks to allow resentencing trials for nonviolent offenders, but opponents of the three strikes law say the measure doesn't go far enough. families lit white candles and set them beside a line of paper tombstones and white crosses representing those serving life sentences for nonviolent offenses. Buried alive, they call it. Paige Getz, FSRN, Los Angeles.
This week, students at the University of Wisconsin are on spring break. And if one state representative has his way, this will be the last spring break the students will have access to the morning after pill, also known as emergency contraception. Wisconsin Representative Danielle LeMahieu has authorized a bill that would prohibit the University of Wisconsin health officials from providing the prescription. Brian Garcia has the story.
The controversy started last week when University Health Services at the University of Wisconsin-Madison ran a series of ads in campus newspapers on health-related topics of concern to spring breakers. The ads encouraged students to drink responsibly, limit sun exposure, practice safe sex, and included information regarding the availability of emergency contraception. Representative LeMahieu says that by placing this ad, the university was promoting promiscuity by advertising emergency contraception.
The message that they're sending to these females is not the right message. I think we can do better. The message you need to send our young people is that there isn't such a thing as safe sex, period. That abstinence prior to marriage is the proper route to take.
As a result of the ads, LeMahieu drafted a bill to prohibit the university from providing emergency contraception. Dr. Scott Speer is the Director of Clinical Services for University Health Services at UW-Madison. Speer says that emergency contraception should not be taken as the primary method of birth control, but it does play a critical role in preventing unintended pregnancies when other methods fail. Speer says the proposed bill is troubling.
Well, I think it's a very dangerous precedent because it's really coming between a woman and her clinician in terms of making the best decision for her health. I think most people agree that the government and legislators have no business getting into that kind of a situation. These kind of laws suppose that the government somehow knows better than the woman and her healthcare provider.
While LeMahieu insists the bill specifically targets emergency contraception, not regular birth control, Lisa Boyce, Vice President of Public Affairs for Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, is not so sure. Boyce says the wording of the bill is sufficiently vague so that it could potentially restrict the prescription of regular birth control as well. Even if the bill only bans emergency contraception,
that is equally egregious because so many women rely on emergency contraception in the incidence of condom failure or if they forget to take a pill or in the case of sexual assault. I think it's important for people to remember that birth control has been legal for over 40 years, and this bill drags Wisconsin back into the dark ages.
The bill is currently shopping for co-sponsors in the state assembly, and a vote is several months away. If enacted, the bill could potentially affect over 50,000 women at University of Wisconsin campuses across the state. In Madison, Wisconsin, this is Brian Garcia reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.